So tonight we're going to start with a part of Java which deals with the fact that it's an object-oriented language. And so I want to talk about how objects are implemented in Java. In Java, as in other object-oriented languages, when you write a program and you want to structure it by dividing it up into modules, unlike a procedural language where you're used to dividing up the program into units of computation, like subroutines, that all are part of one program, in object-oriented languages, you break the program up into modules which have not only computation associated with them, but units of data, so that you have modules which have variables which can hold data objects. These are called instance variables, and they are declared as variables in the class. And they also have functions or subroutines that can operate on objects of those on those data objects. And the functions are usually called methods, and they are in Java. So you might think of it as not just breaking up the program into chunks of computation, but breaking up the program into sets of behaviors. You know, what are the significant ideas in your program? What are the significant collections of objects in your program? You can divide up the program with respect to those objects, introduce instance variables to hold the data for those objects, and then have the methods, which are functions that define how those objects behave. So the class definition is like a template that defines those behaviors. So you can then declare variables to be of that type, the types of that class, and each time you introduce a variable and create it to be an object of that class, it's a new instance. That is, you might have a class which is to represent employees in the company. And you might have as instance variables things like the name of the employee, their social security number, what their salary is. Then you might have methods for increasing the salary or other fun things that has to do with employees. Then you could introduce different instances, employee George, and he would have a set of variables, the instance variables created for him that would hold his name and his social security number. Then you could introduce another employee, Mary, and she would have another instance and would have a set of variables to hold all her data. So you write classes and they are like a template, then you can declare and create objects, different instances of that class. Now, one of the things that these types of classes are used for is called data encapsulation, which is that when you have the instance variables that hold the data of each instance of the class, you don't have to make the values of those instance variables available to other programs outside the class. And that hides the data from programs outside the class. In the case of the employees, for example, you might not want people that declare a class for George and that declare instances George and Mary to directly assign new values to the salary field. Maybe you only want them to use a special method that you have that checks and makes sure that people aren't assigning exorbitant salaries to different employees or something. So instead of allowing people to directly assign and access variables to hold the data of the class, you can write methods that are going to do that, and then you can control to a certain extent how they access those variables and hide details of the data representation from other programs which use the class. Now, one of the ways in which this is different from procedure-oriented programming, which you're used to if you program in a language like C or Fortran, is that in those cases when you write a subroutine, you usually write it to be used in a particular program. I mean, there are cases where you write libraries of subroutines which can be used over wide classes of programs, But in general, you write sort of self-contained programs that are broken up into modules. In the object-oriented view, when you write classes, it may very well be that you think of it more as a standalone module which can be used by other programs as necessary. So you need to have a definition of how to use that module, that class, and that's sometimes called the API, the Application Programming Interface, and what that interface will tell to other people who want to declare and to create instances of this class is what are the variables that they can access, because sometimes you do allow people to access variables. Sometimes you hide them for data encapsulation. And what are the methods that the other programmers can use to operate on objects of this class? And the instance variables and the methods that other people are allowed to use when they create objects of this class are created with a keyword called public. So here's an example of part of the interface for a class called date, which actually exists in the Java language. It's a public class, so other people can use it. And it actually, in its own definition, it has a bunch of instance variables, but they are all kept private. None of them are made public, so the instance variables are not part of this API. This is the public interface. But there are a set of methods that people can use to operate on things of class date. And the way that you create instances of a class date is that you call special methods called constructors, which have the same name as the class. So here's two constructors. They're both called dates, and that's okay. You are allowed to have more than one constructor, and they are different because they have different numbers and types of arguments that are allowed. They will behave the same in that they will create an instance of the class date. And in fact, the constructor date without any arguments constructs a date which whose value is the current date and current time. On the other hand, you can call this constructor, which will construct a date with any year, month, and day which you give it. So you can use these two constructors to construct different kinds of dates. Once you've created a date, how do you use it? Well, you're allowed to use a whole list of other methods, and I've only listed a few of them here. Some of them do things like access the data. So, for example, if you have a variable that you've created, which is a date, you can say get hours and get back the hour part of that date, or you can say get year or get month and so on. If you want to change the date or change parts of the date, you also have a set of methods to do that. These are called the mutator methods. So there's a set of methods like set hour, set year, set month, which allow you to change parts of the date. So even though you can't access the instance variables directly, which hold the value of the date, there's a set of methods supplied to you that allow you to change pieces and to get at pieces. There are other public methods. An example is a method called after, which if you give it another date as an argument, will compute if that date falls after the date that's the instance of this class and give a Boolean result, true or false, depending on whether that's true or false. So notice that this is just the public interface for how people use this class. In the actual class definition of the Java date class, there is a whole set of instance variables which are not made public, which keep the year, the month, the day, the hours, the seconds of each date which is created. There may be other methods which are also not made public, which are just kind of helper subroutines used internally in the module. So how do you use a class like the class called Dates? If you have a program in which you want to have various dates, then you can declare variables of type date, and here is the syntax. If today is a variable name, you just say today, and you give date on the left-hand side. And this is true of declaring variables of any type, any class. Any class name behaves as a type, and you can use it on the left-hand side of a declaration to declare a variable to have that type. And it declares that that variable is going to be an instance of that class. Now, when you do this variable declaration, you haven't yet created the instance. That's a separate operation in which you use the keyword new followed by the name of the constructor. So to create a date, you say, to create an instance of the class date, you say new date, and then you give whichever arguments you want depending on which constructor you want to have executed. Now you can put those together, and I'm going to show you that in, here's a little teeny class that's going to use the date class. So the class, this class is called date application. It has a main function. Notice that the first statement here combines the declaration of the variable today to be of type date, and also with this equal sign assigns it to be this new date that's constructed here. So you can combine the variable declaration and the construction, but you don't have to. There are cases where you don't want to do that. But that's the first statement of the program, is to declare the date and to create a new one. And with this constructor, as I said, the default is if you don't give any arguments, you get today's date. Now the second statement here, I've introduced another variable which I called medieval, which is also of type date, and I create a new one by calling the date constructor with the year 1400, December 25th. So note that I have here two instances of the class date. So there will be created two sets of instance variables that are going to keep track of the values of these two dates. And I could, of course, create many more. Now I just wanted to show you an example of calling a method. So I can call any of the methods in the class, but I have to say which instance of the class I want that method to operate on. And to do that, I use this dot notation, so I can say, use the date that's in the variable today, dot, and I can use any of those methods, like get month or set hours. In this case, I'm using the method called after. So I say today.after, and it's going to call the method after with respect to the particular instance of the date class called today. And what that does is it also takes an argument, which is another date, in this case medieval, and it compares to see if the date represented by the variable today falls after in time the date represented by the variable medieval. Okay? This is a very quick overview of object-oriented programming, I realize. So you may have noticed that in the class date application, really there was only one thing, a main function, and that is an example of a class that was introduced just to do a particular computation. So in addition to introducing classes to represent data and the methods that are going to operate on them, you quite often, in object-oriented programming, when you want to write a program where there's just going to be one instance of the program, you also put it as a class. And you might call that a computational class. It's one which is only intended to have one instance. And I'm not quite sure why this entire image didn't load. So by the way, did you all pick up copies of the handouts up here? So you have hard copy of this. I don't want to click the reload because last time I did something unusual I crashed the whole thing. So let's just pretend that we can read that. You have your own copy. So this is another example, a class called Count, which all it does is has one, it's an example of a Java application. It just has one method called main, and it's there because it's going to do one computational instance. In this case, I believe what it does, I can't quite read it, is to read input until you get to a minus one, read characters, and count the number of characters that are read. So those are the programming building blocks that you use in an object-oriented language. They're all classes. When you want to write a program, you put it in a class that has, you know, a computational body. When you want to have data objects, you create a class which has instance variables to represent that data and methods, which are functions to work on them. So now let me say another word about some of the detail about making a class definition. When you give a class definition, here is the syntax down on this third bullet. You give the keyword class. In front of it, you put any number of class modifiers, which may be other keywords. You give a name to the class. This is one you make up. Then optionally, you can put that your class is going to be a subclass of some other class, and we'll talk more about that later. If so, you say extends, but give the keyword extends, and give the name of the class that's going to be the parent of the class you're defining. And sometimes this is called the superclass, the parent class of the class you're defining. And you may also put that the class you're defining implements an interface. And again, we'll talk more about that later. Now, if you're familiar with C++, you may know that when you define a class, you can make it be a subclass. You can make it have more than one parent. And this is called multiple inheritance. This is not allowed in Java. In Java, you're only allowed to have single inheritance. You're only allowed to have one parent. And this solves a lot of the problems that C++ has with various kinds of class casting and coercion. But sometimes you do want to create a class which inherits behaviors from more than one parent. You may want it to be be a subclass of the class applet. You may also want it to be a subclass of the class thread, for example, if you want it to have threads. So the way that Java handles this is that there is this notion called interface, which specifies essentially the API of some parent classes that you might want your class to also have behavior of. But it doesn't specify sort of what are the, it doesn't give the bodies of any of those functions. It only gives the interface, you know, the declarations of the instance variables and the methods that are going to be used. And I'll show you later how that works out so that you can, in fact, define classes which are going to behave like different parent classes but really only extend one parent class in the subclass relationship. Now, when you define a class, as I pointed out in the date example, you need to give a constructor method. They have the same name as the class that you're defining, and you can have more than one constructor method with different numbers and types of arguments, and that's called overloading. If you're allowed to have two different methods that have the same name, that's called overloading, and you're allowed to do that. And the compiler can always tell which of those two methods you're trying to call, because they are required to have different numbers or different types of arguments. Java is a strongly typed language. You have to declare the type of every variable, as I mentioned last time, so that when you call a method like the constructor of a class, the Java knows what are the types of the arguments that you use. So I mentioned that when you define a class, you have class modifiers that you can give, and here are some of them. I'm not going to go over details of all of them. One of the possible things is that you say that the class is abstract, and this is what you want when essentially you want to define a set of behaviors, define the API without giving the bodies of the methods. What you're expecting is that this is going to be a parent class that nobody actually ever creates any instances of, but it's a place to put definitions of methods that all the subclasses are actually going to implement. So that's what an abstract class would be. These other class modifiers have to do with sort of the scope rules. You define a class, other programs may want to use it, but there's a set of rules about which classes other programs can use, and that depends on these class modifiers that you put. If you put public, anybody else can use the class that you're defining. You may be defining a class that you only want to be used by your program. In that case, you may want it to not to put a class modifier, which means that all of the classes that you're defining within the same directory can use it, or you may want to say private, which is only the classes within the same file can use it. There are some other class modifiers which probably aren't going to come up in the kinds of Java programming which we're going to do, so I won't go over them. Now, within the class definition, you're also going to declare a number of instance variables and a number of methods. And essentially, we talked about how to declare variables, so I don't need to go over that. Here is the syntax for declaring methods. That is, you have a set of method modifiers as well. You have a return type. You give the name of the method, and then you give the argument list in which you give the name of the argument and the type that it has for each one. You give the argument type first and then the name of the argument. So return types can be any type. That includes primitive types like int and bytes and arrays, as well as class names. So you can return any object for any class that's declared to be of any class type as the result of a method. The method modifiers also have some of these keywords like public, protected, private, which again govern who can call this method and what is its access. And again, public is what makes this method accessible to anybody from another program that wants to use a method in this class. Let me just mention synchronize. We'll be talking more about that later when we talk about multi-threading, but this is one of the keywords that you use to make sure that the body of the method can only be executed by one thread if you have concurrent execution. So now we want to talk about what are the relationships between classes. And as I already mentioned there, one of the relationships is that of a subclass relationship, and that is called inheritance in the object-oriented terminology. And traditionally, object-oriented people say that there's three types of relationship between classes. The first two, well, the second one is really just a special case. So the first one, so let me concentrate on it, and that's the relationship of use. So if you've declared a class with a bunch of public instance variables and methods, then some other class can declare an instance of that and use those methods, and that's a case of class A using class B. Then inheritance is that class B is a subclass of A. So B extends class A, or is a subclass of A, if it has all the variables and instances that A has, plus it may have more. So this is a kind of specialization. If you declare a class which you're intended to be a parent class, it will have all the instance variables and methods that a group of classes may have in common. Then you can define subclasses which will have those instances, those variables and methods, but in addition they may add more. And in fact, you don't have to repeat the definitions of instance variables and methods in a subclass. It's assumed that you will inherit all of the instance variables and methods that are in the parent. So remember that you, from the previous slides, that you, when you want to define a subclass, you say that it extends another class, and then that other class is its parent, and you, in fact, will inherit all the... It's as if you repeated the declarations of all the instance variables and methods from the parent class. You don't have to repeat them. You just get them automatically. So how does this work, that you can have a subclass that inherits instance variables and methods from a parent? Let's just concentrate on methods for now. So here is a situation in which there's a whole class hierarchy defined. Up at the top we have the parent class, and it may have some instance variables and methods defined. In particular, there's one method here. So every class which is a subclass of this is assumed to have a method of that name. So for example, over here, every subclass of this parent class is assumed to have a method of that name. It doesn't have to define it. Okay? So if you have some other class unrelated to this whole class hierarchy, it can declare, so suppose, for example, over here, this class at the bottom was that date class that we had as an example. Some other program, some other class can create a date object and declare it, in which case it's created something over here that's represented by the name object 2. It's an instance of this class. And it can say whatever the name, so object 2 dot the name of a method which can be defined either in the subclass or any of the classes above it as in the parent hierarchy. In particular, suppose that this object calls on object 2 the name of a method that's only in the parent class. What happens is that the Java interpreter will go to this object to look for a method of that name, or the Java compiler, excuse me. There's not actually a definition of a method of that name in this class, but it knows that this class has a parent, so it goes there to look. If it's not there, it will go up here and look, and it will find the method of that name. Why is it okay to call this method on object 2 down here? It's okay because not only does object 2 have all the methods, but it has all the instance variables that the parent did. So imagine that this method is operating on instance variables declared in the parent class, but those variables are assumed to be declared down here as well, and so it's fine to call that method, and it will work on all those instance variables. Yes, to look for methods of a particular name. Okay? So that's sort of simple inheritance. Another thing that is useful to do is sometimes you may want the subclass not to inherit exactly the method of that name that was in the parent, but to create its own, to have slightly more specialized version of that method, perhaps. So a subclass of a parent is allowed to have another definition of a method of the same name as the one that was defined in the parent. And this is called overriding, so that the child class can give a new definition of the name that exists in the parent class, and it will override the definition of the parent. So here, in a similar situation, this is why you look for the method names from the leaf up to the top. If object 1 creates an instance, object 2 of this class, and it calls a method that was defined in the parent class, it will look up through the class hierarchy for methods of that name, and it will find the one which is the most specific to the child class, and it will call it. So I mentioned before that when you want to convert, have an object which is converted from one type to another, you can use something that's called casting, which is you put the name of a type in parentheses in front of a reference to the object, and it will be converted to something of that type. And this kind of casting is available for classes as well. People always say that there are two forms of casting, but actually one of them is automatic, and that's widening, where you use an object of a subclass as an instance of the parent class, and that's just automatic. That always works, because if you're expecting to have an object of the parent class, that means that you're expecting to have the set of methods and instance variables that the parent class has, and the subclass has those by definition of being a subclass. So it's always okay to use an instance of the subclass where it says you're supposed to give an object to the parent class. So suppose you're calling a method and it says it wants an argument of type parent class. You can give an object of type of the subclass because it will behave, it will have all the behaviors defined by the parent class, and that will be okay. Now the opposite thing is not true. So if you really want to use a member of the parent class as a member of the subclass, you do explicitly do this casting. This is called narrowing, so that the conversion is performed explicitly. Last time we talked about arrays, and in a lot of ways, arrays perform like built-in types, like the primitive types. But in some ways, they behave as if they had a class definition. For example, there's an instance variable of the class array, and it's called length. So for any array that you have, you can say the name of the array dot length, and you get the number of elements in the array. So the class array is treated as if it has one parent, and that's the class called object. There is a superclass called object, which is the parent of everything. So it is the parent of every Java class in the class hierarchy. Now, in most languages, you make a distinction between what is the value of a variable and what is the handle or the reference, the address or pointer to that variable, because it might behave slightly differently. And Java is pretty much the same, except, we'll see how it works out for, in particular, we want to see how it works out for passing parameters to methods. But first, let's consider assignment. If you just say A is assigned B, if they're primitive types, then actually A is assigned to the value of B. And later, if you change B, A will remain unchanged, because A has the value, in this case, of whatever B was. Suppose it's 66, and after you assign A to be 66, it doesn't have any relationship to B. But if A or B is an object, in fact, if B is an object, it's really a reference to an instance variable of the class. So when you're doing assignments like this, B behaves what you might expect a reference to it in some other languages. So if you assign A to be B, then A really refers to the same object as B. It's as if they referred to the same location in memory. They had the same reference to an object. And if you made changes to the object that B pointed to, then A would refer to those changes. A would see those changes because now they both point to the same object. So in fact, in Java, you say that the arguments to methods are always passed by value, but in fact, primitive types behave exactly as they're passed by value, but objects really are references, so they behave as if they're passed by reference, the way that you would consider passing by value and reference in other languages. You can clone objects. I don't know if that behaves the same way as the copy in C++, because I'm rusty on C++ and I forget how that works. But if you want to find out more about that, I would look up the cloning. Clone, C-L-O-N-E. Okay. So I realize I've given a very fast overview of how object-oriented programming works in Java, and if you've had some object-oriented programming before, I've made lots of references to concepts that you know about, and if you're kind of new to object-oriented programming, that may have sounded kind of mysterious to you. So the thing to do is to look at some examples and see how it actually works out in practice, and especially in examples of the type that you might be writing yourself in order to write applets, Java applets that work on web pages. So this particular example, is an example where I find that Netscape on a Macintosh doesn't always refresh the screen properly, but we seem to have done it here. So last time we talked about some really simple graphics, like drawing a rectangle or drawing a circle. But one of the things that you can do in Java, of course, is write a loop in which that rectangle or circle that you drew moves. And here's an example of one where you've introduced two rectangles, and there's a loop which makes them move across the page. And of course, this is a very simple example of the kind of motion you might want to do, and there's a lot more complicated ones. So let's think about designing a class that's going to represent these rectangles as they move across the page. Well, first of all, it's easy to draw the rectangle. We know how to do that. But what might we want to do to remember the state of the rectangle as it moves across the page? Well, we should have a set of variables that can remember what are the x and y location of the squares, the rectangle, and we might want to generalize this so that there are different colors, so we might want a variable to remember what color it is, so that we can have one rectangle that's red and one that's blue, and in addition, we might want the rectangles to move at different rates. In this example, they were moving at the same rate, but you might want one to move at different set of offsets than the other. So you can think about having a class, which in fact, we might want to generalize this so that there are different shapes. So let's think about having a parent class, which is going to represent moving objects, and it's going to have an x and y location to remember where the object is, and an offset, dx and dy, to record what are the sort of the rate of motion that the object is supposed to take the next time it moves, and a color, which is the current color of the object. And then we might have a set of methods which can do things like change the color, change the rate, And then actually a method which is going to move the object, which means that we're going to update the x and y location by the offset and repaint the object in its new location. So I have some slides in the talk that sketch out this example, the source code for this example. The example as it was working is in one of the tutorials in the under the Java resources on your class webpage. So you can go and look at that and see the actual code. Actually, to introduce this in class, I simplified the code a little bit so that I didn't, just so that it was easier to introduce and fit better on the slides and all that good stuff. So first, what I'm going to talk about is a class called Endpoint, which is going to be the parent class of all objects that we create that are intended to move around our Java applet space. Like that particular applet that we just looked at had two squares that moved around. So we will define the variables that are going to hold those values and the methods. Here's a list of the methods. I didn't have room for the variables. Set delta, set color, move, and paint, which are going to be defined in this parent class. Then we will define subclasses. Rectangle is going to be a subclass that actually, in addition, the parent class for movable objects is going to assume that everything is a point and doesn't have any width and height. Then rectangle will assume that things also have width and height. And then from there, we can make even more subclasses which have different shapes. So we'll talk about how to create this parent class and how to create some of the subclasses. And then finally, I can show you a version of that applet which actually has a loop, which is going to go through and make the it will introduce the two rectangles and have them move across the page. So the parent class is called Endpoint, and I talked about the design. Here, in fact, are the variables that are going to represent any movable object, and I have an x and y that are integers that are going to represent the pixels, the current pixel location of the object, dx and dy, which are going to represent the current offset that you're supposed to move it by, and we're going to we didn't initialize x and y, so they're just declared, but I initialized dx and dy to be plus 1. So that's moving one pixel to the right and down as you look at the applet. Then I have a variable called color, which I initialize to be black. So these are the instance variables. They're non-public, so that people who declare movable objects can't actually assign to these instance variables, but we will give a set of methods that enable people to change their values in a controlled way. Here is the constructor. There's one constructor. And the constructor, when you initialize an instance of the movable point, you call the constructor with an x and y value. And what we do with those is to initialize the x and y that is the instance variables of that instance of the class. So you always give the initial location of the object when you create it. Now we also give methods where you can change the default values of those other variables. So there's a method called setDelta, which you can give it a different dx and dy. And all the body of this method does, there's these two assignment statements that assign the arguments to the variables dx and dy. Then there's one to set the color. So here's the assignment statement that does that. And this may, if you're not used to object-oriented programming, this may look a little tedious, because all we're doing in these methods is allowing people to assign values to the instance variables. But as I tried to point out in the introduction, this is a good way of doing it because you can change how you represent all these instance variables, and people who use the class don't have to know because they can still call these methods, and you can make it all work without them actually knowing exactly how you're representing the values that represent the object. Well, anyway, there are two more methods. One of them is called move, and one of them is called paint. So move is what we want people to call when they actually want to have an object, the object move. And what we do is we increment x and y by the offset. So this, whatever the current offsets are added to the values of x and y. Then we call the paint method. And what the paint method does is we've given it right here. It draws, in this case, this is a movable point, so it just draws a dot. Okay. So now that I've defined the parent class, mPoint, for movable points, I can actually define a child called movable rectangles. And in the declaration of the child class, I say mRectangle extends mPoint. So that exactly says that mRectangle is a child of the parent class mPoint. So what that means is that everything that I declare of type mRectangle will also have as instance variable x, y, dx, and dy, and color. You don't have to redeclare them here. You can just assume that, that they're there, that you can use the instance variables on objects of this type without having to copy the definitions. And that's why it's called inheritance. You inherit all the variables and methods of the parent class. But what makes this a child class is that we can add more methods and instance variables. So we can add the two instance variables, w and h, to stand for width and height. Now, we do have to give a constructor for the child class, and we're going to give a constructor in which you give the initial location, x and y, of the upper left-hand corner, and then you give the initial width and height of the object. In order to record the argument under bar x and under bar y and in the class variables x and y, I just call the constructor for mPoint, and it's called super. There's a key, special keyword super, which means call the constructor for mPoint. Yes? Oh, right. Thank you. So there's a typo. There should not be a return type on this class. You don't have return types on class. So that void should just be crossed out. Thank you very much. Yes? You could equally well, in this case, have just said x equals under bar x and y equals under bar y. No, because you can assign directly to the instance variable. Yes. Yes. Of the parent class. Yes. But there are a lot of different ways to do this, and I'm just trying to illustrate some of the different ways. Then in addition, we want to record the arguments under bar W and under bar H into the class instance variables, and that's these assignments. So now we have defined all of the instance variables. If somebody creates something of type rectangle, this constructor will define values for all the instance variables of the class because all the other instance variables had default values, right? So if you call mRectangle with a value for x and y and w and h, you'll get an object of that type with the default dx and dy of the default color black. Now, we inherit those other methods for set delta and set color, so we don't have to repeat those. If somebody creates an M rectangle, they can use set delta and set color to change the color of the rectangle. Now, actually, we chose not to allow them to change the shape of the rectangle, so we don't have a set W and a set H. We didn't allow them to change the width and the height. So that was our choice. We only have moving objects, not moving transforming objects or something like that. But there could be other applications that would want that. So finally, we also inherit the method move from the parent class, which is going to change the location of the object by updating the instance variables x and y, and then it calls paint. But we're going to give a new paint. So this is an example of overriding a method in the parent class. The parent class had paint, which just drew a dot. This has a paint, which is going to draw a rectangle of the right width and height. Okay? Yes. It will call the paint in the child. If you create an object of type M rectangle and say to move it, it will call the paint in the child because it's the closest to the child definition. But if you had an object of type N point and you moved it, it would call the paint in the parent N point. No, it always calls for you the paint which is closest to the object that you're calling it on, as far as that parent-child hierarchy. You can use the keyword super to refer to methods in the parent, but that's the immediate parent. I think you can pile that up to go on up the hierarchy. I haven't done that, so I'd have to check on that for sure. So I thought we should look at an example of how to use those rectangles. And this example that uses them is a stripped-down version of the applet that I showed you. And it has some features that I haven't told you about yet, like it has something called a thread, and I'm going to tell you about that shortly. So for now, we'll just look at this example. And what I want this applet to do is to have a drawing area, start with the two rectangles in the, I created a red rectangle and a blue rectangle, there were two of them, start with them in the, for you, upper left and upper right corners, and then have them move one pixel at a time down and across the applet drawing area. So obviously I have to have a loop which is going to keep calling move on each of the objects. All right? And it turns out that when you have an applet which has a loop and or does some other lengthy computation, you need to put that into a thread to run independently of the browser window. So what happens is that an applet is running essentially in procedural language as a subroutine of the browser window. And if you have an applet which is taking a long time to run, then the browser window can't respond to other things that the user may do, like try to resize the window or move some other window on top of it. It will essentially freeze up the browser window. So what a thread does is enable you to have a lengthy computation which is going to run concurrently with the browser window or to run parallel. So the browser window is running independently and seeing what the user is doing and where to move all the windows on the screen, while your applet is figuring out how to move those rectangles. And I'm going to show you more detail about how to do threads in a minute. But it's, I wanted to leave that in this example because it's an important part. So I'm declaring a class, defining a class called test. I'm importing all the graphics. Actually, I'm importing everything from the abstract windowing toolkit, but it includes the graphics. I want this to be an applet, so I say that this class that I'm defining is extending the parent class for all applets, java.applet.capitalapplet. Remember that upper and lowercase matters, so these are two different classes. So everything that is going to run as an applet in the browser window needs to be a subchild of this class, java.applet.applet. In addition, I want to be able to declare this thread. So I say I'm going to implement the runnable interface. And the runnable interface is a very simple interface. It says that anything which says it's going to implement runnable has to have a method called run. So if I'm this applet, by declaring that it's going to implement the runnable interface, is guaranteeing to the compiler that it's going to define a method called run. Then there is a part of the thread package that says that anything which implements runnable will have a method called run, and if you create a thread, you should use this run method as the body of the thread. So I'm throwing a lot of concepts at you very fast. We'll go over this again later. Although I must say, I'm trying to do Java in I think I'm going to have to go at least 4 lectures, which is a very short time to try to teach Java in. So I'm just trying to get you enough that you can write some simple examples. But anyway, that's what all the definition of the class here means. So we're going to declare a thread. So this lowercase thread is the variable named thread. The capital T is the name of the class. And I'm going to say more about threads, but essentially you start and stop them running, and then you give it a run method in which you define the main computation of the applet. So anytime you have a lengthy computation or you have a loop for the applet to do, you declare a thread and you put everything you want to do in the method called run, instead of, as before, we had a method called paint, which we did the main part of the applet, because all we were doing was drawing one thing to the browser window. Now we have a more extensive computation, and it's all going to go in the method called run. So first of all, there is an important type declaration up here, which is that I'm declaring this variable called object, lowercase object, to be an array, all of whose elements are going to be of type endpoint. Then I create essentially the descriptor for the array by saying give me a new endpoint of length 2. So that is going to allocate space for an array of length 2. It hasn't yet actually constructed the elements of the array because this is an object type. So here at the top of the applet, where I declare variables, these variables are essentially global to the entire applet. Every method that I write in the applet can access these variables. So if you have a variable which you want to be accessed by more than one method, you declare it first here. Then I can write various methods. One of the methods I want to write is the init method. That's the one which is executed as soon as the applet is downloaded. So in the init method, I'm going to initialize my 2 rectangles. Was that a question? No, okay. So to do that, individually, I create the elements. So recall that when you declare an array of length 2, you use as indices the values 0 and 1. So the first element is at object sub 0, And now I actually create an M rectangle to start at location, pixel location 10:10, and to be 100 pixels wide and 100 pixels high. Now, you may say, but you declared that array to have, say it would have elements of type M points, and then you created an object of type M rectangle. This is a case where it's okay, because the array is expecting something of the parent class. It's always okay to give it something of the child class. So in fact, I could say that this object array was going to, all the elements were going to be M points, and I could give different things. Later on, I'm going to define circles and triangles as well. And so each one could be, one could be a rectangle, one could be a circle, one could be a triangle. It would be okay because they're all children of M point. So in any case, I create the rectangle in the first element, and I do a set delta of 1, 1. That's unnecessary, but I just, felt like making it look complete. And so that rectangle, it starts in the upper left corner over here for you and goes down and to the right. And I initialize it to be red. So notice that after I've created something of type M rectangle in object sub 0, I can use methods from the class M rectangle on that object. So I say object sub 0 dot set delta, and that's going to call the method on the object of type M rectangle. Of course, the method set delta wasn't actually defined in M rectangle, but it was defined in the parent, and that will be okay. It will go find the set delta out of the parent and call it. So I do set color to be red. Then in the second object, I do a similar thing. I create a rectangle that starts with x pixel value 200, so that's over on the right, and it's the same size, but I have it move in the x direction to the left and in the y direction down, and I set its color to be blue. So that's all the initialization, and now since this has a thread and it implements runnable, the main computation is put in this method called run. This, what I'm not showing on this slide is, I'm going to show you later, is in addition to the run method, you should have a start and stop method of the applet that starts and stops the thread. And we'll talk more about that later. But I just didn't have room to show it all. So the main method here is all it's going to do is have a loop that goes on forever, essentially, that is, as long as the thread is not null, that means as long as the thread is defined, it's going to wait for 20, I think this is milliseconds, and then it's going to repaint the screen. And repaint is a special applet method which calls update, which calls paint. Wait a minute. Right. So I'm going to show you on the next slide what the paint method looks like. Now, you may have questions about this try and this catch. It's very hard to give examples without explaining the whole language to start with. But essentially, anytime you have call a function which may have a runtime error, like thread sleep can have runtime errors if there's a problem. So you put that inside this special statement called try, anything that can cause a runtime error, and then you give the keyword catch, and after that, in this block, you say what kind of runtime errors you're going to handle, and then you do something to handle them. In this case, I do nothing to handle it. But anyway, so I had a loop which is going to keep calling repaint. So the first time, though, that the applet starts, the browser will automatically call paint. And so I have a method here called paint, which sets the background color to be black. Oh, on this on the Mac it didn't turn out black. I may have a different version of the example that I was actually showing on the Mac. Well, I know I do because it doesn't have Flickr, but very close. This is to set the background color, and in this version it was black. This is the actual drawing the background as a rectangle, which fills the entire browser, fills the entire applet part of the browser window. Then I have a loop from that goes through the integer values I equals 0 and 1 and calls for objects of 0 and for objects of 1 the method paint, which is going to paint the two rectangles. So I don't have so my paint method draws the background and then initializes the two rectangles in their current location. Now, every time around the loop, it calls repaint, which calls this method called update. Now, the applet has a definition of repaint, and it has a method called update. But I'm a child of the applet, so I can override the update method that the applet has with my own. And I write an update method, which draws the background to be black, and then loops through, and instead of just painting the two rectangles for each one, I call the move function, which updates X and Y and causes it to be repainted in a new location. So this is where the heart of the applet takes place, is that every time around the loop, this move function is called so that the two squares are drawn in a new location. I have a slide here on overloading constructors. Suppose you wanted another constructor that actually took things of type point instead of values x and y, but I'm not going to go over that now. Let me just show you, though, the definitions of the circle and the triangle. These are both children of rectangle, and they don't need any more instance variables. They inherit all the instance variables from rectangle, so they have x, y, w, h, b, x, d, y, and color. It has its own constructor, mCircle, which takes an x, y, a w, and h, and it just initializes the instance variables x, y, w, and h by calling the constructor from mRectangle by using this keyword super. Now, the other thing it has to, it's going to inherit all the other methods it needs, including the move method, but it wants to give a different paint function so that if you declare something of type mCircle, it'll call this paint function instead. And this paint function draws an oval of equal width and height, and so you get the circle shape instead of the rectangle shape. And then we have a similar one where M triangle can also extend M rectangle. It has the same idea. It uses X and Y as the upper left hand corner. It uses the width and height as kind of a bounding box around the triangle. again, I can write this simple constructor which uses the constructor from mRectangle, and then I redefine paint. I didn't have the drawing package didn't directly have something for drawing triangles, but I just calculated how to draw three lines that would draw the triangle. So I talked to you briefly about abstract methods. There are things which have the declaration of the header of the methods, but it doesn't have any bodies. And an interface is like an entire class, a set of interface variables and methods, all of which are abstract. They actually have no bodies. And you expect that some other class which implements the interface will have all those instance variables and provide the methods that will give the body. So interface does what the title implies, which is it just defines the interface, what it means to be a class of that type, which instance variables and methods it should have. So I'm not going to have time to go through this entire interface car example. You can use interfaces like types in all the other kinds of type definitions. And let me just say, I also have some notes at the end here about a little bit about how to make packages. If you write a big enough applet that you have lots of different classes defined, you probably want to start to structure them so that some of them are in different directories. And these are called packages. So you can have two different classes, in this example, wheat.java, stone.java, that are in a directory called mill. And so the package structure directly reflects the directory structure that you keep them in. And you do put the keyword package inside the classes that are all supposed to be in the same package. They can be grouped hierarchically so that you can make directories of directories that have packages in them. Here's a list of essentially all the packages that come with the Java system. Java.lang is what contains all the essential Java language classes. That's where you find Thread and Math. And you don't have to import these. They're always assumed to be there. Java.io has all the classes to do I.O. Actually, applets aren't allowed to do I.O., but we'll be also talking, I think, briefly about applications. Things like println are here and read. Java.util is all the stuff that should have been in Java.lang but didn't make it in time. So date is there, plus a lot of other data structures like hash tables, vectors, and so on. Java.net has all the stuff to do to go fetch URLs and to connect sockets across the network and do distributed kinds of programming. Java.applet has everything that supports applets. We'll talk a lot about that, as well as the abstract windowing toolkit about how to do user interfaces. There are some image processing classes, and there's also a set of classes that actually tells how to implement the windowing stuff on specific systems that you never get to see. We talked briefly about exceptions, and here are the notes on exceptions. So I'll leave you to study those. Note that in addition to, I discussed the fact that when you call a method which can have a runtime error, the runtime error is called an exception, and you must call it in this try statement and then have a catch thing which is supposed to handle the runtime error. Actually, if you call a method which has a runtime error and you don't want to handle it, that's okay too. You just throw it yourself. You say, I don't handle this runtime error. I throw it up to whoever calls me. And here's an example of a method which actually creates a runtime error by doing something suspect, by like calling divide by zero, or trying to open a file that's not there, or any number of other things which can cause runtime errors, in which case you have to, when you declare the method, you have to say it's going to throw a runtime exception. So that's a little bit about how the runtime exceptions work. There's also a hierarchy of exceptions. So, for example, there's a lot of different array exceptions, like invalid index, no such element. You can choose, if you call a function which is going to possibly call array exceptions, you can choose to handle them all, or you can choose to handle individual ones. Okay, and so that's the end of this part of the talk. I spent more time on the object-oriented stuff than I wanted, but next time I will do a little bit about threads and start more about the windowing, how to make buttons and all sorts of other interesting features on the runtime system. Finally, I would like to say that you're just getting now the accounts installed so that you won't. I had made the assignment due on Wednesday to have on your web page a list of what you've read about Java, and you won't be able to have Wednesday as your due date to have it on the web page because you don't have your accounts yet, so you can't do your web pages yet. So I'll try to fix, if I don't get it fixed on the assignment web page, then know that that's not a deadline. You don't have to have it on the web page by then. But do please do the assignment. That is, do some readings about Java Is there anyone who tried to get a Java book and was unable to get one? Did anyone try at the bookstore? I ordered a large number of Java books for another class, so I don't know. So everyone was able to find a Java book who needed one? Okay, I just wanted to know if I needed to order more in at the bookstore. I ordered the Didel and Didel.